If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder. Mike Ray was a former cop and body double for a world-famous action star. He was ready to put show business behind him when he was asked to do one last favor for Hollywood's hottest new actress. All he had to do was find her the necklace from a forgotten film and not get killed in the process. From the insane house parties of Malibu and the reclusive mansions of Beverly Hills to the scorching California desert, Mike finds himself in a scandal involving one of the world's most eccentric billionaires, the Nevada Mafia, and the sadistic Estonian porn kingpin. To find the necklace, he'll have to blow the lid off a secret in the California desert that stretches back to ancient Egypt, with an irresistible client who won't take no for an answer. If the job doesn't get him killed, she just might. Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main has been described as the Big Lebowski meets Indiana Jones. It's only 99 cents on the Amazon Kindle store, or wait until the end of this podcast when you can hear the first two chapters read by me, Justin Robert Young, for free. Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main, available now for only 99 cents on the Amazon Kindle store. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Weird Things podcast, recorded live for an audience of freaks and mutants and other delightful souls. I'm your host, Andrew Main, joined by the other host, Mr. Brian Brushwood.
We should point out that, like, there are freaks watching, but, like, we have a barrier so we don't hear their laughter. It's like recorded live in a studio audience if we treated their opinions with utter disrespect and contempt. Like, maybe you're laughing, but we don't want to hear it because we're in the zone right now.
That was Brian Brushwood. Also joining us, Mr. Justin Robert Young, is it?
No, that's what they call me, folks. Old Justin Robert Young. How's everybody doing?
How much money would I have to give you to change your middle name to Roger?
Like, I don't know. We could probably, I don't know. How much you got on you?
For $1,000? Brian, he'll do anything for money. Like, he'll move across country.
For $1,000, would you legally change your middle name to Roger?
Dude, he'll move to Oakland. He'll do anything.
Yeah, there's literally no limit. I'm just that big of a whore.
So, we need our news. Brian, how can you sit there and laugh and giggle while Justin and I are in a war zone?
I'm sorry, yeah. Did you say you're in a war zone?
Are in danger while you mock us.
Wait, is this because of the SpaceX thing? Like, you're afraid that it's not a real missile. It looks like a missile, but it's not.
Brian,
it's a rocket.
We'll get to that in a second, okay? Okay. Thank God for SpaceX. That's all I have to say. At least somebody has a plan.
Okay. Well, what's the problem? I don't see any war. Unless it's like a secret war.
What's the problem? Oh, I don't know. Because, like, you know, where I live in Austin, sort of, place, but you can't really find where my house is on a GPS. You know, we're used to, like, people eating other people like zombies attacking one another in public places in broad daylight, and the police have to bring him down with multiple bullets. Because that's normal. That's normal, Brian. But you're safe. You're in a little compound in Texas. Well, Justin and I are like, we're like ground zero for a zombie outbreak.
Yeah, dude. What is it with Florida? I mean, can you just, since you're getting the hell out of there, Justin, and you're choosing to stay.
Leave it to me to handle Florida on my own.
Like, can you speak for your state and
I'm going to get away from these freaks and move to San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah. Where the normies
finally
are.
Some normalcy. it's terrifying. You know, I need to refer to a fan of this show, Petey Rave, who I saw this afternoon, who upon asking whether or not we would be talking about this particular story, immediately broke into his own jingle, which went a little bit like, chew in your face, high on cocaine, Naked Bridge Zombie, you better watch your speed.
Was he high on cocaine? Was that part of the story?
No. Word is now bad LSD.
Yes, that's the new one. It was on LSD laced bath salts.
All right, for those listeners that have been living under a rock, apparently Miami MacArthur Causeway, a very high profile bridge. It's a very famous part of Miami. Police came to the scene where they found one man on top of another one eating his face.
Like, that's not a euphemism. That ain't even, oh man, he was eating his face right there while everyone was watching.
Ripped off all his clothes till he was naked, and he would not stop, so they had to shoot him multiple times.
The other guy was naked too, right? The face ED?
Dude.
The face eater was naked. He was the one that ripped off his clothes. When he saw the body on the ground, that was the dead face eater.
So what, what was he high? Did I hear right? Bath salts?
Well, apparently with the kids these days, smoking bath salts has become a thing.
Yeah, I know like a lot of them are secretly supposed to be like synthetic marijuana or something. And it's supposed to be like, no, whatever you do, only use it in the bath. Certainly don't smoke it and get wicked high because the FDA hasn't caught up with the latest chemicals that we figure out how to put in here.
Yeah, so it's that, but this was laced with LSD. Now, a little local context to this story. Memorial Day weekend has been in the news for Miami in a negative light over the past couple years because of a urban beach weekend that has descended into some gang violence recently. And so imagine you're the city of Miami and you're making your way through urban beach weekend. Everything's going fine. There's no shootings, no kind of really out of control story. You're feeling pretty good about yourself right up until a dude eats another dude's face on a bridge naked.
All right, there's two things. First of all, I suspect that's why it got so weird. It's like a rubber band. The longer it's peaceful and everything's cool, that just means the harder it's going to snap when it does get weird. But number two, you realize that moment that you've seen in so many movies actually happened when the cop shows up and like, hey, you, they actually had the guy covered with blood all over his face go and look up at the cop. That happened.
Maybe. I mean, like, yeah, we don't know whether he made the, I mean, like, he might have just made the like, buh.
I'm going with the.
Yeah, come on. It's got to be that.
What if it was like some like vaudeville kind of punchline? Like, well, but you should have seen the other guy.
You know, and we're sitting here laughing, and there's a guy in a hospital with half his face missing.
Now, were they? Yeah. They were both high.
I haven't heard that.
I mean, no.
I mean, what's the okay? So if the one dude was high, the other dude's what? Just walking down the street?
Maybe just walking, minding his business. Like, hey, I'm gonna go check out Ultra. I'm gonna go listen to some music. You know, be cool, man. I look at the tunes. Nice, beautiful day out there, man. Yeah. Wonderful, sunny. Everything's great, man. Yeah. What could go wrong?
And not only shocked and surprised to find out that Ultra was a month ago, but also he gets his face eaten by a zombie. it's a horrifying universe for this particular fellow who now lies in intensive care.
So meanwhile, you know, we've got some poor guy in the hospital who we have no idea how he thought his day was going to start. Last thing he expected was it to end up like, might I say, a scene from one of my novels, Public Enemy Zero, where I have the first public zombie attack takes place on a South Florida bridge.
Wait, and does he eat his flesh?
He tried to.
Wow. Yeah, I believe it's an Officer Merritt that goes after our protagonist in a South Florida bridge.
Do you feel any responsibility for this? It's clear that
I feel somebody's going to get sued is what I say.
And so that means let's move on to another story.
Well, I think I'm going to sue Mr. Zombie Attacker.
Oh, I see. Wait, sue the estate?
I think he's in a bit of hot water, you know, in general, that fellow.
Well, I mean,
watch that body in the morgue.
Okay. See if it comes back.
Let's get Jon Snow in there to make sure that he's really dead, because you just can't tell on these things.
Oh my God!
Meanwhile, thinking of other horrible things you have to deal with, we've got a young woman who is dealing with a flesh-eating bacteria, which is apparently she's lost. She's asked them to go ahead, cut off my hands. Which at first I heard that she said cut off my hands, but then I heard her media report where she just now was able to speak. So
Well, I mean, you can nod. Like, she had tubes and stuff in her.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I assume if she's conscious, they're like, we're going to cut off your hands, you know, up and down for yes, left, yeah, right for no. And then,
I mean, but that's like, isn't, you know, that kind of like, where does, and this is just me being ignorant in terms of like the medical liability and stuff like that. But like, at what point is it not your decision because you're kind of out of it and time is a factor with the spread of this virus? Like, do you have the right to say, like, no, dude, I'm just rocking and rolling with,
yeah,
with what?
I mean,
well, yeah, I think you do. In fact, the author of Predictably Irrational, Dan Ariely, if you ever see him on a TEDx talk, it's obvious that he's got burns on one side of his body. And in his new book, The Upside of Irrationality, he talks in great detail about his very personal experience about getting the chemical burns at the age of 18 and being disfigured and having to go through this agonizing, painful, because you got to keep the scar tissue moving, otherwise it all hardens. And at one point, they're like, we really should just cut off this arm. But he, you know, by his own explanation, irrationally feels an attachment to his arm. And he's like, no, no. They're like, no, you don't understand. It will be miserably painful. It will have very little use, and it will be difficult forever. And he, you know, what, 15 years later, is like, yeah, starting to wonder if maybe I should have cut off this arm because it pretty much hurts all the time and doesn't really work very much. But that's how loss averse we are. And so I know it was in his decision, and so he decided to stick it out. So for good or for ill, I guess you can refuse the advice.
That's hard. Remember Bob Dole? You know, that was when he damaged his arm in World War II, speaking of Memorial Day, by the way, and that was one of the things where they're, you know, we think we're going to have to lose it, and he refused it. Didn't want them to take the arm, and you know, the nurses walk into his bedroom or into his hospital room, and he's like holding on to the fire, you know, the whole water system there, trying to do chin-ups.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
trying to make it happen.
And he's like, "Hell, cutting off my hand, you know, I'm keeping this."
Yeah. Wow. Well, I know there was actually I must have been going through. Oh, it was Philadelphia Airport. I was traveling through, and I don't ever watch sports anything. And there was some sports documentary about a kid who had his legs amputated, and you know, because it's a sports show, it was about the rad, you know, robot legs that he got and how he took up biking and now bikes hundreds of miles or whatever. But leading up to it is the story of why the kid needed his legs amputated, and that's because his dad backed up a riding lawnmower over his son. And it's like, and they kept, and it wasn't just like, well, these is messed up, let's cut them off. It was like they stitched everything up, and he just had, I mean, it was just bones, you know, it's like just flesh, God. You know, and he couldn't get around, and it was painful all the time for him. So he it was out of the question to do anything athletic. And so finally they had this decision, like, all right, let's cut these off. And of course, you know, through the magic of the storytelling they do in this kind of documentary, a couple of days before the surgery, he runs into this this 70-year-old man who bikes, you know, dozens of miles every day, who is a double amputee, who, you know, has special equipment, and he was able to tell this kid all about it, and they became fast friends or whatever. But it's like, how amazing, like, there are these gray zones where it's like, your life will absolutely be better. Let's just chop off that flesh and make you part robot. And you'll be happier for it.
You know, we're at a very interesting point where we mentioned this, I think, in a prior podcast with leg amputations. The technology for leg replacements now is sophisticated enough that, you know, below the knee, you know, you can run at Olympic speeds. Above the knee, that's still incredibly capable. When it comes to arms, you know, an arm is a much more sophisticated mechanism as far as the fine motion and the sensitivity there. And that's, you know, we talked, I think you mentioned it, Brian, the Dean Kamen TED talk where he showed the Luke Skywalker style arm that he's working on. And,
yeah,
you know, we're going to get to a point where you can grow your own or whatever. It's encouraging in some ways that people who would have thought they would have to be in wheelchair and crutches for the rest of their life can now compete in Olympic sports, which is, I mean, not Paralympic, but actually to the point that judges have to say, well, should we allow them or not? Or are these a good
advantage?
Well,
they're like superior. I mean, there was that one cat, you know, who had those awesome scissor legs that they were, the question was like, I mean, these are springy legs. This is,
yeah. Oh yeah.
Should we just allow
everyone to be allowable for competition?
Yeah.
I think everybody should read the very interesting work that Dr. Kurt Connors is doing on arm regrowth.
Coming out.
It's promising. It's
very, I'm looking forward promising. To his presentation this July.
Exactly.
Do we want to do a sponsor?
Indeed we can, Andrew. I would like to recommend that everybody go ahead and listen to the Band Library Podcast. It's the worst library podcast on the internet. Listen to Evan and Halbert talk until they quit, filling your ears with possum facts, library news, Cheers reviews, and rambling. Folks, it's the Band Library Podcast, and they are one of our sponsored listeners this very week. Remember, you can follow in their footsteps. Head on over to weirdthings.com/sponsor and buy your own $30 Weird Things listener sponsor spot.
Brian, Justin.
What?
Yeah.
We're failures.
No, wait.
Okay, shut up. Stop it.
I mean, I'm a failure and Justin's a failure, but you have multiple best-selling science fiction books.
We're all failures.
Well, at what?
You know, yeah, people
are we unlucky at love?
Listen to the show and they hear a lot of rah-rah capitalism, rah-rah free markets, rah-rah, you know, individual rights, you know, free speech.
Yeah.
These crazy notions.
Yeah, we win.
These capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes.
Well, because you think that we're living in a successful system.
Yeah, clearly we are, because I've got red, white, and blue tattooed on my forehead.
We're living a lie.
Yeah, you're a lie.
No, I will show you we're living a lie.
Okay. All right? Okay. Go on.
So that was a lie. You telling me that I'm going to tell you we're living a lie.
Well, you're
like a lie cake with a lot of lie layers and then some frosty lie frosting.
It's like a tres leche lie cake, if you catch where I'm going.
A tres leche.
Yes. This is like lie causing a chemical burn.
A fond full of lies. You ready for this?
Lord of the lies.
Besides anything involving like space, what would you say would be the coolest technological achievement you can
miniaturization.
Have What's that?
Miniaturization.
Wrong. Justin? Build Jurassic Park. You're correct.
Laser guns.
Build Jurassic Park. Okay. Now, dinosaurs.
No, not dinosaurs. Maybe
no,
skin
it's
cells.
Building
that...
dinosaurs. I said this. It is
no,
building.
I'm thinking more like, what was that last part?
It is known, Brian.
But, Brian, this is established. It is filled with dinosaurs. Did you see Jurassic Park?
Yeah, but did you see Creepshow? That last one where the guy had all the bugs? That was scary.
So anyhow, building a Jurassic Park, that would be considered high tech. That's like it. We brought back extinct species. We've done that. Success, right?
Yeah.
Spared you are no expense. Possessing godlike powers, Brian.
Wait, are you talking about the woolly mammoth thing? Bringing back the wolves?
Better.
What? But better than a woolly mammoth? A bully rammoth.
Okay, so we're saying that this represents... I have come across a collection, a dossier, if you will, of photographs.
Go on.
I'm looking at these photographs, and I see animals that have been extinct forever.
Forever?
I see those big, huge, you know, mammal things that were taller than elephants that they based the AT-AT walkers on.
Wait, woolly mammoths. That's what I said. You just said back
no,
my animal.
No, man, they're bigger. They're something else.
Mastodons.
I see they're Tyrannosaurus, mastodons. Okay? I see Ankylosauruses. I see all the awesome extinct animals.
Wait, you're just watching Walking with Dinosaurs.
I am looking at an actual place where they exist and they roam free.
That's
so, but what is this? Paradise. Is this
Larry Ellison's Instagram? Like, you know, where is this happening?
It's a new app that he has for the iPhone. You put extinct creatures in your wacky photos.
It's just like, I mean, like, dude, the guy lives in like a geisha house, like a gigantic Japanese manor, you know, allegedly eating endangered species on his yacht. It would be not weird at all for Larry Ellison to just start tweeting pictures of, you know, like, oh, yeah, no, there's an Ankylosaurus in my backyard. No biggie. You want to bring your kid over?
All right. So,
did we ever argue about which was the coolest of all the dinosaur creatures? Ankylosaur versus Triceratops?
Let's not break stride here, bro.
All right, I'm just saying,
do you want me to get to this? Do you want to just
go?
I'm trying to reveal to you.
I need to find out.
All our premises are wrong, are flawed, horribly, horribly flawed, totally wrong. Because apparently, this place is real. I'm looking at photographs of these dinosaurs roaming free. And where is this, Brian? Where is this?
At the Museum of Natural History, where science comes alive.
No, a mere 90 miles away on an island. On an island where one man began an ambitious experiment. Sound familiar?
Yeah. Where is this? I don't believe you. What? This is too awesome.
This man's name is not John Hammond. This man's name is Fidel Castro.
Oh, wait a minute.
In the height of the Cold War, while we were building missiles and bombs and planning world domination,
he was lying.
Fidel Castro got a bunch of inmates to go take over a park outside of Santiago, Cuba, and they built the Valle de Prehistoria on 11 hectares of land.
Wait, and they claimed they passed them off as real?
I don't know if they passed them off as real. I mean, they kind of were just sort of not moving, but they're made of concrete. But there is an entire Jurassic Park theme park in Cuba filled with concrete dinosaurs that covers several acres of land.
I'll tell you what. Thank God there aren't more baseball players that are smart and ambitious, because this is what happens when you spend your entire formative year sitting in an outfield thinking about things to do. Like, you want to know what? I want to solve the injustices of capitalism by taking over a country. Also, I'd like to build a park of concrete dinosaurs. I need to quit baseball.
I like the idea that, you know, we don't have any toothpaste here because that's a capitalist luxury. Let's build dinosaurs. Let's build concrete dinosaurs.
Now, here's the critical question here. Where is the mini golf course?
That's a bourgeois suggestion.
Whatever, you imperialismo.
You're telling me they fill up multiple acres with concrete dinosaurs. They don't put a single front nine for us to rebound off of. Boo, communism!
No. And, you know, being Cuba, you would think at least a soccer ball or something. But no. They're the one to be seen.
That's sportsist.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, they could put, you know, because they're a huge baseball culture. So, you know, they can just put one in the outfield. You know, imagine on the short porch to the left, you just have a big pterodactyl. That'd be hilarious.
So this was on Io9, and it's the Jurassic Park was built by prisoners in Cuba. They conscripted inmates to build over 200 concrete dinosaurs.
Man.
Now imagine if that was like, you know how in American pop culture, we kind of have the idea of the prisoners breaking rocks with like the pickaxe.
Sure,
you know,
stamping license plates.
Yeah, that. I mean, what if in Cuba, that's their trope?
They're all terrified.
Like, you don't want to go to prison and build a concrete dinosaur. Go to bed early. Jose,
what are you going to say, Juan Pablo, when you look up and say, how should I make the Tyrannosaurus's arm? And they answer, I don't know, just make it up. It's
they're all
matter.
Doing all the dinosaurs are doing the thing with the arms in front like they're doing the creep, you know,
Man, that as far as prison gigs, though, you could do worse than make a bunch of magical creatures.
You know, and meanwhile, at Disneyland and Epcot, you know, we're achieving whole new tech capabilities and ride tech. Our rides actually moved. Come to America. Our rides move.
they really don't. You kind of just have that one thing. So what do? You drive in your 1947 Chevrolet in 2012?
What are you, the richest man in Havana?
That would be a great pamphlet. The richest man in Havana. And you just open up. It's like, I don't know. It's
there is a reason. Florida has some of the best doctors, best mechanics, and some of the most highly qualified people in the world because some people in Cuba said, you know what? The hell with this place and your concrete dinosaurs. I'm going to America where
they have real dinosaurs. Less,
they're still janky, mind you, but they move. Moving dinosaurs.
That's right. And then, do you think they show up and they're like, they were hoping maybe we had actual dinosaurs, but they're like,
maybe
these
that was like
fake.
Castro standing on the beach in Cuba smoking a cigar going, ha ha, they lied. I was about to give him a German accent.
He lied. He should. Achtung.
I just imagine it's like, oh, Juan Carlos, do you hear in Epcot? They have a hall of presidents. Presidents just talk to you over there. Like, man, I would really love to see that. I would actually get on a boat and float to Florida
actually take
to see
my
that. 52 it sounds
Ford
awesome.
And make it into a boat and go see that. Which they can do,
by the way.
That's true.
Indeed.
And all what's right, well, cool is, like, we've got all the really, really clever ones here now that could, like, figure out how to turn cars into boats and stuff.
Yes, awesome. Car boat business sorely lacking these days in old Havana town.
Hey, speaking of the wonders of commercial enterprise.
Yeah, Justin, buddy.
Do we have a commercial to support this enterprise?
I would like to let everybody out there know that, again, we are sponsored by the WanderersPathsBooks.wordpress.com. You can read the first five chapters of his upcoming six-part sci-fi fantasy book series, The Wanderer's Path. Just head on over to WanderersPathsBooks.wordpress.com, and thank you for supporting the Weird Things podcast.
Very cool. Very cool. And I love the fact that we are kind of a nexus for sci-fi, all kinds of cool stuff. People who find different things here. It is awesome, and it's great to see that our fans and people out there are out there telling stories.
Yeah, man.
Gentlemen. So we talked a little bit earlier on the whole zombie thing.
Mm, yeah. Potential alleged zombie thing.
Somebody has a plan, because tell you what, outbreak happens. Remember, you'd be like, I'm like, I'm going to go to sea. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a pirate.
I do remember that.
Note that. You know where we're going?
Where?
Where?
Canaveral, SpaceX, Falcon 9.
Wait a minute. How are you
blow this rock?
Wait, you're gonna leave the planet? How long are you gonna how many Snicker bars can you take with you to space? You guys are gonna be starving within seconds.
We'll think through that part of the plan when we need to.
Okay. All right. So your plan is to go up in space a few 100,000 feet above us, and you think you're going to be safe?
Well, yeah, like 225 miles up.
All right.
Ryan, when you're in space, no one can hear you squeal with delight because you're outside of the zombie outbreak.
Yeah, Brian, pretend you're Sergey, I'm not a gay, on board the ISS, okay?
Right.
All right, you're like doing your mission. You're on your Lenovo pad computer from like 1992. You're doing some like playing some Tetris and doing some space work, okay?
Sure, sure. I'm sorry, that sounded good. Actually, at first, I don't even look up.
You're the Russian. Come on, you're Sergey.
At first, I don't even look up because I'm not really thinking about the fact that I'm on the ISS. I'm like, comrade, could you get that? And then I'm like, what?
And it's the ISS, so you got some Danish dude like Hans Shortpants is with you, too.
He's sitting there with his lederhosen on, playing the accordion, the space accordion.
Exactly.
And then there's the American Larry.
Get that. It's me, Hans Shortpants. What's up?
He's like, Achtung.
Open up, baby.
Well, you got to, there's a knock. Where's this knock coming from?
Well, I don't know. Let's knock back. We'll just.
No, you're like, where is this knock coming from?
It's obviously coming from the space door.
Don't be such a Glockenspiel, Sergey.
Why don't you go out the door?
Ugh, comrade.
Go to the space door, and this is what you see. Justin, help me out, all right? You can describe to the audience.
We have Americans. And then he's just like, he cracks it open just a little bit. He's just like, yes. I keep wanting to make him
German. There are zombies in Florida. Help us.
He's like, comrade, the zombies. I cannot, we have strict policy. Nats said no solicitation.
We built this thing. Not as literally.
No.
We built it on rock and roll, I was informed.
Man, I wonder what you realize, like, give that 5 years, SpaceX will be in a position to make unannounced visits.
Okay, all right. Well,
hey, what's going on? Elon Musk is flying by, knocking on the space station. I'm building my own down the road. Just thought I'd come say hello.
Oh my God, imagine the publicity. Ding dong ditch.
Yes, like the space. Imagine the publicity of Elon Musk just going for a space joyride. The world's first space joyride. The world's first space social call. He shows up and he's ding ding, and he just hands them cupcakes and he's like, "Peace out," and then he sails on back. That would be amazing.
All right, I want everybody right now, if you are listening to this, to go ahead and read Andrew's post that went up on Weird Things Today called I forget what the title is, but it's about the space boom.
Two words. Yeah. Space boom.
Very simple.
Those are two very good words. I like space, and I like boom.
Well, listen, I mean, like, a lot of people, and you've seen, you know, a gigantic amount of attention, and I think, I mean, just a lot of really exciting feedback from the NASA or the SpaceX trip with NASA's funding, the Dragon capsule, up to the International Space Station. First time that's ever happened with a commercial entity. Obviously, we spent the entire episode last week talking about it as me and Andrew were on our way up there to see it launched. But, you know, Andrew, explain just a little bit of what you talked about in the article about, you know, what this means for us in, and as he puts in very, very geek-centric terms, before the Game of Thrones series will be wrapped up on television.
Oh, before we even get midway. And we're going to talk about some of the politics and economics of this. Brian, I called him up a couple days ago. I'm like, you want to make me, want me to make you mad? Want to be mad? I'm going to tell you something that's going to make you mad.
Yep.
And did it make you mad?
I can't remember what it was. What was it again? Because I'll probably get mad about it all over again.
SLS.
SLS. Wait, say it again?
Oh, yes.
What is it? Remind me.
The we'll get to it in a second.
Okay.
He just blocked it out. He was so mad.
No, I know as soon as you say it, I'm going to get
drunk,
mad.
Got drunk, got violent.
I punched old ladies and sent them into space.
SLS!
So here's the thing is that, like, my uncle, by the way, I've never talked about this. He was a big time, like, you know, rocket scientist guy. You're like, we're shocked, Andrew.
Yeah.
And he designed, like, control systems, all kinds of stuff. And my mom was talking to him about this, and he's kind of like, you know, oh, big, you know, he's kind of like, well, we've done that kind of big deal. So what, whatever kind of thing. Okay.
I can't read that first word.
So anyhow, but the thing is like this, is we go like, all right, the first step is SpaceX, you know, in 10 years has gone up there, has built a rocket and has done what has been done before in some terms, but based upon entirely new technologies. Okay. The SpaceX Merlin engines are built off of their own design. They, you know, they inherited designs that went back from, there was Apollo designs, stuff the Nazis built. Remember, the first country to put a thing into space, not orbit, but space, were the bad guys with the V2 bombs.
Wait, that went into space? So I guess suborbital flight, huh?
Yeah, that was suborbital, but they went that high up. Okay.
Yeah.
So
and that's and those things massive. I was telling Andrew today. If you ever, if anybody's in the London area, and you've not been to the British War Museum, it is an absolute must go. And they have a full V2 rocket in their lobby, and it is the most insane thing to think that that those. Pounded, many of those pounded London.
Who was that awesome Nazi female pilot who, like, when they were working on their rockets, one of them kept listing to a side or something, so they sort of just wedged in a joystick and they put her in the freaking rocket and they said, go for a ride, and then she was able to control and she's like, oh, it feels like your back rudder is running on this. I'm gonna have to look this story up, or maybe I'll kick it to the folks watching live and see if they can find me a link to it, because I can't remember her name, but it's freaking extraordinary.
You lost me an awesome female Nazi pilot. I'm just going to say that.
Look, man, say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism. She knew how to fly a rocket. That's all I'm saying.
So, anyhow, middle of all this attention on SpaceX, Elon Musk has been kind of very forthcoming about SpaceX plans. And incredible achievement, what they've been able to do. And we'll get into in a moment, like, all the other current companies that are trying, that are working on this, that have NASA contracts. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to handicap them for you based upon my vast experience at staring at my Starship Enterprise model.
That's why they call you the space bookie. Space bookie main.
Elon Musk has come out and he said, well, how are you going to move the technology forward? What's going to be the next step? Besides the fact that already the entirety of this system that we saw was privately paid for. This is now NASA contract to go there, but the rocket, everything was developed with private money for less money than it cost to make John Carter of Mars and Green Lantern.
What?
Okay. So
what?
Putting in terms, like, we could have had two SpaceX. So anyhow, what is the next step? Next year, 2013, SpaceX plans on, again, these things have a habit of slipping because it is rocket science. SpaceX plans on launching the Falcon Heavy. The Falcon Heavy would be the largest American rocket system since the Saturn V, and it would be the largest rocket system since the Saturn V globally. Now, the Russians had the Inertia system, but that was putting, like, a Buran, and that never quite – they did one successful launch, and so I'm not sure, you know, how the people who keep records like count this. But anyhow, it would be a humongous rocket. Next year, SpaceX wants to put this up. Falcon Heavy, largest capacity, more than the shuttle. Side note, when the Dragon capsule docked with the ISS, it is the largest cargo capacity that we currently have of any nation that can return to Earth from the International Space Station. More space than the Soyuz.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
There's a European and a Japanese rocket. They go up there, and then they burn up on reentry. You don't put people in there.
Right.
Unless you just don't like them. So Elon Musk says, hey, listen, this is the next step. He tweeted out a photograph, which right now, if you go to Space Boom at theweirdthings.com and you see this, it's the last photograph there, and it's really an amazing photograph. And it's a night shot, and you see what looks like the lower stage of a rocket. And then in the corner, you see a little line, a little white line, and that is a time-lapse photo of the International Space Station and the Dragon spacecraft flying overhead. The rocket you're looking at is a test rocket in McGregor, Texas, near you, Brian. We get zombies. You get this.
Is this it right here?
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, for our people watching live, if you look in the right corner, you see that line, okay? What you're looking at is that's the time-lapse of those of the International Space Station and the SpaceX Falcon, excuse me, the Dragon flying overhead. That rocket standing right there is called the Grasshopper. That is a test rocket because SpaceX is pouring a ton of time and people and energy and money into developing a fully reusable rocket. That is their test rocket on the launch pad right now.
Now, this was this is not a new direction for them to go. He's been talking about this. You forwarded me that article from 4 years ago to the day of the actual launch back in 2008, where he was saying, they were asking, what is the most significant advance? And he said, a fully reusable system. And then he goes on to just trash what a joke the space shuttle was in terms of a reusable item. It was more expensive than building brand new rockets each time. And
oh, that, goodness.
And the most important part, you know, the giant tank of fuel was not reusable, and they had to build a new one of those each time.
And we'll get into why. And this is NASA is filled with brilliant, great scientists and engineers who have to deal with the burden of working within a government bureaucracy and having to appease senators and congressmen. And we'll get into like how bad it really is for them. And so sometimes we've come out, you know, probably a little NASA bashing at SpaceX expense. And that's been more of the nature of the bureaucracy. Nobody has been more excited of this outside of SpaceX than NASA, because this gives NASA whole new capabilities.
So it gives them the freedom to follow their original mandate, you know? Mm-hmm. They were essentially supposed to be the Federation of Planets exploring brave new worlds.
Exactly. And NASA now says, you know, we're going to look beyond Earth orbit, et cetera. It's like, imagine if NASA had to build every computer they used, every truck they used, everything to do like that. They would never be able to get anything done. Now they have SpaceX and other companies, Orbital Sciences, which will be launching soon, other companies that can do that and allow science to focus on the science and exploration part of it. So Elon Musk has talked about a reusable rocket. Now, what does reusable really mean, okay? When the Falcon 9 took off towards the International Space Station, there were two primary costs other than the service cost. There's the cost of the rocket, which is about a $60 million rocket. Then there's the cost of fuel. The cost of fuel to send that capsule to the International Space Station was about $200,000. To send a 737 commercial airplane around the world, you're looking at $260,000. Cargo capacities vary, but in understanding scale, to send an airplane around the world, passenger plane, 737, you're looking at $260,000 in fuel cost. To send the Falcon 9 to the space station, $200,000.
So
that's how little it costs compared to the rest of the launch cost.
Now, when you were talking about 2013 is when they're going to launch the Falcon Heavy. Is the Falcon Heavy supposed to be fully reusable, or this
Not,
is still
eventually? No. Eventually,
no. Okay. But see, I guess that's the great thing is like they can build just a traditional dumb rocket right now. And then eventually explain for those who haven't seen the animation what a fully reusable three-stage rocket looks like.
So you have like three stages to your rocket. You have your primary stage, which gets you high up. You have your secondary stage, which is a big part. And then you have your upper stage, which is what goes into like orbit, okay? The primary stage, this big, huge chunk, well, imagine it separates. The first one to separate, okay? And it's going like in like Mach 3 or something like this point. It would fall
Normally
back into the atmosphere,
fall.
It would right itself, its rockets would then ignite, like not all the rockets, like one of the rockets with remaining fuel, and then land itself back onto the launch pad.
All computer controlled, right? Like just
that?
All computer controlled. Like the computer is like, go back home.
Yeah. And then the second stage would do the same thing. And so if you drop these things, you put up parachutes on them, you drop into the ocean, they're going to get damaged on impact. And even worse, they're going to get saltwater corrosion. It's like dumping acid into engine parts. It's bad.
Right.
Landing on the
really
launch pad
like
this.
It's really hard to aim a rocket to land in a pool or a freshwater stream. Very dangerous to do that.
So what happens here is each stage lands back. They go in. Imagine like a 737 jet. You pull into the airport. Mechanics get out. They go check all the little parts of it. They look at the computer gauges, and they say it's ready to go. They refuel that sucker, stack it up, and it's ready to launch again. When you can do that, and if you can get 1,000 launches out of that rocket, you divide that $60 million cost by 1,000, and you get a $60,000 cost, $60,000 per launch capital cost. Add that plus your price of fuel, add another $40,000, whatever. You're looking at that point, if you want to divide that, you're looking at a launch cost of, let me pull up my statistics.
I mean, less than $1 million for sure, right?
What's that?
Less than $1 million for sure.
Well, your cost per, yeah, your $300,000 per launch, your cost per pound is now, let me get the precise figure before I go, okay? Your cost per pound now comes down to $15 per pound.
What?
What was, do you know what the space shuttle cost per pound was if you factor in the entire cost of the program?
Wait, do you realize like at that weight, it becomes like to deliver a pizza to space becomes only like $40 or $50? Literally, to deliver a pizza, dude, to the International Space Station.
For the same price scheme as a high-priced lady of the evening, you can send something to space.
Musk wants to do this with the Falcon Heavy, which would put the cost below $10 per pound, okay?
Oh,
do you know
God.
What the cost per pound, the true cost per pound was with the space shuttle?
We've been throwing around $10,000 to $20,000 per pound, but I don't know if that's true or not.
$30,000
per pound?
$30,000 per pound. Okay.
God.
Now, there are cheaper ways to get into space, but $10,000 is always considered, you know, by the guys who've been in the industry, that's it. $1,000, am I frozen?
No, just your video. You're good.
Oh, that's fine. $1,000 was always that magic price point. When you could get below $1,000, that's when you could do really cool economics in space, businesses and stuff.
Now, I'll tell you what I'd love to – I want so bad for there to be a simple resource that everybody can wrap their mind around that makes it worth it to go up there. Now, we hear vague terms like, you know, harvesting minerals from asteroids, whatever that means. And for a while, we heard about helium-3 on the moon might be worth picking up. And we hear vague promises of – medicines that can be made in zero G, but I can't name a specific on any of those. And
I'll tell you what, then you should really go read Andrew's post on weird things.
That's awesome. Is that what it's about?
Brian, it's about, I'll give you the synopsis here. It is about the three sectors, the three biggest sectors that are going to totally change our economy and bring us accelerating growth from enormous ways. Okay.
Yep.
When you get to that really low cost, when you're talking below $10 per pound, okay, mom and pop businesses can start talking about businesses you could do in space, but forget them, okay? First thing that happens is communication, all right? Right now, we're dealing with dicey internet connectivity, okay? Because the cheapest way to provide high-speed contact, you know, connection is through cables and fiber optics and stuff like that. When you can put satellites up in space at $10 per pound, you can fill space with satellites. Okay. We can put a ton of stuff.
And we don't think that's a problem as far as like...
That is such a minor problem when you're dealing with the economies of scale and what you're doing up there. You have a space tug business or whatever. Space is big.
The answer is yes, you got to track it, and yes, that'll be a problem. But compared to the problems of rocketry, this is nothing.
It's worrying about pelicans crapping on the end of the dock.
Yeah, all right.
We could park this big oil tanker here, but the pelicans are going to...
It's like, well, we're gonna fly hundreds of airplanes in the sky at the same time.
So, and these are, there are little problems that have to be dealt with, but they're such a, there's, when you have that, when it's that cheap, these are easily solvable. So, satellites, okay? You want to have a phone call that doesn't drop. You want to watch a 4K movie on your iPhone. God knows why. You know, while you're in the middle of the outback, do you want people in Syria and Iran to have access to internet
now,
without
their
governments?
That's the important thing. It's there was a really good documentary. It was a little bit tough to watch when they get so hippie with their language, but it was about the folks during the Occupy Wall Street movement who were working on a project to completely distribute completely independent internet of any of the major pipelines, and about
how
it's an idea that I think is important, and it should be the kind of thing. Their goal was for a couple $100s, you basically have this pod and an antenna that connects to other, of
mesh,
the same
type. Yeah, it's an old idea. That's, yeah, the cheap mesh, yeah.
Right, correct. And with the importance being that you don't want to be in a position where the government could shut down the backbone of any kind of internet.
No, the idea of doing the big mesh is a neat idea. The problem with the mesh is that your government troopers go around with a Wi-Fi sniffer and just shoot every single person who has a node. But it's potential. But when you start moving to satellites and line of sight and other things, you all of a sudden you have cheap, abundant telecommunications. People who live in, we're first world. We're complaining about our Wi-Fi access and complaining about our LTE. Most of the world would love to have edge.
Yeah, sure. You're talking about the slow-ass AT&T network.
Yeah, so when you talk about moving 6 billion people, the rest of the planet, over to have fire, faster high speeds, abundant internet access. I pay $100 a month for my cell phone. I pay another $100 a month for my internet and cable connectivity and all these things. And so this is a trillion-dollar industry that all of a sudden the next big huge step becomes space, more satellites, making it much, much cheaper to throw it satellite. If you want to provide, internet coverage using satellites,
so
it's ridiculously expensive.
This is a case where you can get a massive increase in the quality of bandwidth, and consumers will see a massive reduction in expense for it. And that's all based on cheap satellite flights.
Ridiculously cheap satellites that make it cheaper than wiring up node to node.
Wow.
And laying cable and the property rights and everything you have to do with that.
And so, we think about, and listeners to great shows like Tech News Today here on a daily basis, and you talk about it a lot on Frame Rate with Tom Merritt, just the constant butting of heads we have with kind of big telecom. This completely shakes up that entire industry. And now companies that have a very entrenched position where they can leverage their authority in ways that annoy the hell out of everybody now find themselves in a completely different landscape that is really limitless.
Think about the Google model, and I didn't get into this here, Google model for how they run their big server farms.
Right, where everything's in storage containers.
Yeah, they buy a bunch of cheap servers. They put 100,000 of them in a room.
Used hard drives as well, right? A bunch of cheap used hard drives.
And when they go bad, they just leave them there for months until they do their standard repair.
Because they have so much redundancy.
What's that?
Because they have so much redundancy, it doesn't affect their service.
When you get into satellites with a tremendous amount of redundancy, you get into this. So that's communications. That's just one of the things there. And that's a trillion-dollar industry alone that is, when you have that cheap access to space, that's one of the things you're doing. Okay, the second thing is materials. Not the stuff, it's, and like you point out, like it's hard to say, oh, we'll make this or make that in space. But if we, Planetary Resources is committing money right now to try to figure out what's out there using telescopes to look at near-Earth asteroids, because they think there's a lot of these have these platinum group metals, which are very valuable. When you want to make a fuel cell, most expensive component is platinum. Platinum goes for about $1,500 an ounce.
Wow.
One of the biggest problems holding us back in building better batteries and building better fuel cells and making these things really, really cheap is we're trying to find alternatives because platinum is a scarce metal.
Now, what about stuff like I hear about the coming crisis of rare earth magnets or rare earth materials? Is that something that could be found in space theoretically?
You could, but there's like the platinum groups include like nickel and stuff like that. They're up, you'll find that along with like platinum, but the thing about that's more of an economic crisis where we made it difficult in the United States to mine that stuff because of certain environmental restrictions. So we bought from China, and then China has been raising their prices now to the point that we have tons of places here we can mine for it. We're going to go back and open up these mines.
Got it.
But things are really generally where like platinum. So that $1,500 an ounce, if you find an asteroid that's got a ton of it, all of the platinum, all those materials we have on Earth came from asteroids. But now what we're doing is like, let's go look for the asteroid that didn't break up.
Right.
And so that's another trillion-dollar industry that is made possible when you have ridiculously cheap access to space. You go to one of these rocks, it's not like you're trying to dig in the entire Sierra Nevada mountains for platinum. You find humongous large veins.
I'm sure this is not on your list, but from a military standpoint, it seems like once it's cheap to get to space, all of a sudden, if I want true supremacy, that it seems like what I want to do is get a permanently manned station up there just to hang out by all the asteroids and just, you know, because that's if you ever read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert A. Heinlein, that's essentially how the moon gets its freedom, is by realizing that they're at the top of the gravity well, and that's pretty much all the advantage they need, in that they just hurl rocks down onto strategic areas of the United States.
You know, there's a whole nother discussion about all the legalities and the military ramifications, but, you know, speaking just purely in the civilian space thing, and the idea that if it's a big boom, there's going to be a lot of money for everybody, and a peace would be much more of a preferable choice than not, because when you're looking at over 1,500 near-Earth asteroids and we don't know how to mine just one yet,
but we
a lot of potential. So figure out you get into that. So the platinum groups, things like that, where all of a sudden you're actually getting usable resources, and we may know by the end of this decade if that's viable within our current, you know, look of technology. Okay. Third, last big group, and the most important one of all, energy. Okay. You know, what do we want? We want perfect clean energy. What do we talk about? We talk about solar or wind. Okay, wind takes up space, it's noisy, it kills birds, you have to get permit to have wind energy in the United States.
And nobody wants it in their backyard. Everyone complains about it.
Yeah, and it kills, you know, bald eagles. Solar power, you know, people, well, we'll cover Arizona. We'll just cover Arizona. We can't even build an oil pipeline through uninhabited land and cover it with dirt.
Right.
And we think that we're going to go cover Arizona with solar cells. Okay. Where do you have a lot of space? Where do you get 144% energy efficiency and sunlight 24 hours a day? Anybody? You guys know?
What does 144% energy efficiency mean? Where it's like the energy of making the solar array pays out more dividends from the sun?
It means what you would get at the Earth's surface versus what you get out in space.
Wow. Okay.
So it's 144% more efficient than what you have at the Earth's
surface. No cloud cover.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's always sunny in Spacedelphia.
Yep. Except for, like, it's something like 2 hours a year when you, like, you would, in a standard orbit, when you would go into the shadow of the Earth for, like, a certain moment, the equinox or something. It's like, there will be people who will point this out and explain to me, you're incorrect, 364 days and 23 hours of sunlight.
Right.
It's like, and that matters, but no, it doesn't.
But of course, the question is, how do you get that energy down? And I know, you know, there's simple things like just shoot a giant microwave beam down, but it's like, that seems like a giant space ray
to
destroy
things.
That's the
challenge, is that you built an incredibly powerful space weapon, and I point that out there, that you know, but we're comfortable with the idea, most of us, of nuclear power plants that, you know, perform generally are still the cleanest form of energy they have, even when you have things like Fukushima and, you know, what happens in Japan.
Yeah, sure,
you know?
Sure.
So we're already dealing with these dangerous things in some ways, and you dams
cause earthquakes. So what's a giant space ray?
Yeah, come on.
So, you know, there's ways in which, you know, you would manage that kind of thing. How do you keep the space ray from vaporizing the planet? And there, you'd put, just like you secure a nuclear facility, you would do the same thing here. You know, the biggest danger in a nuclear facility is, you know, isn't what happens when people from the outside get there. It's just sort of it not working right. When the space ray doesn't work right, it stops producing energy.
Right.
So says Andrew before the great space burnout of 2022.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know.
Space ray that leveled Cleveland.
I mean, it just seems like in my imagination, you picture the space ray beaming down unimaginable gigajoules of energy, and then like a freaking rock just knocks it, and it just sort of lists across California, carving out a second Grand Canyon.
I am hesitant to be fully like, oh, the problem solved, given that, you know, a cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, one of the most sophisticated pieces of moving equipment on the planet, is sitting on its side off the coast of Italy because some guy wanted to wave at a girl, you know?
Right.
So, but that being said, these are the challenges, but these are, you know, that's the thing, is it when you can have $10 per pound, you can put a ton of solar arrays in orbit, you can start doing things like, there's more water on bodies smaller than the Earth than there is all the water on the Earth.
What? You're talking about on all the asteroids?
Europa has more water than Earth.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes. Correct.
So, and then you go to the asteroids, which have water. The moon has water. You start taking this water, and you have a tremendous amount of solar power. You can start cracking it for hydrogen. You want to get really crazy. We actually have a satellite up right now that tries to collect antimatter, tries to, you know, see how many antimatter particles. Not a whole lot, but when you have a ton of energy, and we've actually increased our efficiency in producing antimatter. Like every
every 10 years, we like double our capacity to produce it. Same thing with hydrogen. Now that's with antimatter.
Wow.
And we might realistically see antimatter production where you have places with a tremendous amount of energy. Crazy, far-fetched.
Yeah, which, I mean, obviously, if you're of the three, it seems like the first one, telecommunications, is the first slam dunk as far as...
Oh, yeah, because that's what we're doing right now. It's already a reason we have a space industry.
I mean, listen, these are all very, very, very exciting things. But there's one thing that watching through all of the reaction to SpaceX and watching all of the giddy news conferences between NASA and SpaceX, which Andrew very correctly categorized as always starting like a Mr. Show sketch with the awkwardly framed desk shot and three people staring right into the camera. It's really kind of, I know for me, and Andrew touched on it before, changed a little bit of how I want to talk about the you know, SpaceX versus NASA thing that I think I know I am very guilty of on this podcast and probably on the website as well, kind of setting up as a one versus the other kind of thing. Because the more you kind of see reaction from NASA, like we said before, they're very excited about the idea that they can now get out to space and just do more work out there in space. The options have just exploded for them exponentially. And really, if you kind of read between the lines, and this is something that's kind of dominated conversation between me and Andrew, between us watching the launch and doing this podcast, is that it's not really... There's a lot of people at NASA that didn't like a lot of the really annoying things that we were frustrated about the NASA organization to begin with. Chief among them, just the sort of no-bid, you know, crony capitalism culture that had kind of pervaded it. And I think that's really what I would like to on the podcast, just kind of get across to people that, you know, that's what's annoying. You know, people... You know, wrapping their absolutely counterproductive, no bid culture around with the blanket of it's a public agency, we're all doing it, you know, that feel good kind of cloak, when really it was hampering for the last 30 years our ability to get into space. And Andrew, you had a particularly galling example that you found.
So, if you step aside from what SpaceX just accomplished, along with, you know, a very enthusiastic and jubilant NASA, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of learning from SpaceX, talking to NASA engineers, both the ones working at SpaceX and existing NASA scientists and technicians, about what are the challenges, what do we need to know. When you step aside from that and you look at what's going on in the other companies that are going out into space, there are several private companies. There are more private companies trying to build spacecraft or space vehicles now than you have companies trying to build passenger jets.
What?
So the next one up, so NASA has this program that SpaceX was part of, which they got grant money to try to go to the space station. And then after doing that, they get funding to do cargo missions to the space station. And there's other and try to do this, okay?
I'm sorry, hold on. We lost you there for a second. You said there's a what?
Other companies that are involved in this too, okay?
Right.
So we've mentioned before Orbital Sciences. They've been launching satellites for years. They're next up. They're going to try to do a cargo flight. And I'm going to tell you I'm going to tell you the thing about all these in a second. There's Alliant Tech Systems, which has been part of like some bigger conglomerates. They're developing the Liberty rocket and a passenger spacecraft system. They're not getting NASA funding, but they have an agreement. You know, if we develop this and we get to a certain point, NASA will consider testing it, et cetera. Boeing is developing a crew module to be able to take astronauts to and from the space station and put it on top of other rocket platforms. Sierra Nevada is building a thing called the Dream Chaser. It looks like the shuttle that the Bionic Man crashed in.
Awesome.
Okay. And then there's Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, which I've finally found out more about what their plans are.
The only thing I know about Blue Origin was they wanted to do the Buck Rogers-style single stage to orbit and land.
They have a single stage that can do suborbital, and then they can put it on top of other stages to do orbital.
Okay.
So that's what we know now.
But it lands Buck Rogers-style, completely.
Yeah,
rad.
Very, very vague about that. Well, that's what Elon Musk is doing now with the capsule that SpaceX is building for taking crew to the space station and back would go on top of two-stage rockets, and then that capsule would land via rocket power.
Well, and that was the idea being that it would be an escape capsule. If there's a problem on the launch pad, they'd be able to launch this thing off and it lands itself, you know, a few miles away, Buck Rogers style. But that same functionality would allow it to land theoretically on Mars.
Elon Musk is like, listen, if we got rockets in this thing, let's run the numbers to see what if we just want to have it land from orbit like this.
Yeah. Well, yeah. He talks about that, how in certain areas of Mars, the atmosphere is so thin that it would be useless to even bother with parachutes. So you might as well have controlled rocket landings.
So that's that program. And I'll get to the bigger program in a second. And the thing is that all of them, to my knowledge, except for SpaceX, are using leftover boosters from the Soviet era, leftover engines from the Soviet, or designs based upon that, which these were capable rockets. And the exception is, I'm going to get to a lie in a second. These were capable rockets, capable engines that did a good job, that were very, very good, but the technology's advanced since then.
Yeah, sure.
So it's building a program on surplus hardware where people go, well, SpaceX copied designs. Or like SpaceX looked at what worked, but they make their engines, their rocket engines are made outside of Los Angeles entirely.
So when you say using, you mean they're physically using leftover rockets?
Orbital Sciences' next launches will actually use rockets they found in a warehouse in Russia.
What?
Okay.
You want rocket? I have rocket. Just get your rocket. It's no problem.
Now, they got the license to make those engines afterwards. Okay?
Okay.
One of these companies has a license to continue making these engines.
That's a little bit terrifying.
We've been launching since outside
the space shuttle.
You said
he's good rocket.
All of our military satellites and stuff that we've been launching so far have been launched on Russian rocket engines.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, it makes sense by the numbers, but on the other hand, it's just like, I can't shake the image like Justin says. The guy's like, I make countdown. You press button and go to space. Eh? What is problem?
My cousin Olaf, we watch warehouse. No one goes into warehouse. We sell you rocket. It's fine.
It's good.
It's good. It's great rocket.
We cut lines of cocaine on this exact rocket. It goes to space.
So you have that's and meanwhile, the Russian space industry, a lot of the really smart young people that are going into oil and gas and in the space industry there is kind of in a precarious situation. So some of these rocket systems, like here's my complaint, and I'm an ignoramus, and there may be people who work in this industry who are going to say, man, Andrew, you're an idiot, but what the hell? If you're frustrated by the way things work because you know, oh, why are private companies doing this? It's the way it's always worked. All rockets have been built by private companies under contract with the government. But the way that it worked before was, if you're a company that wanted to build a rocket engine, you'd go to Washington, you'd pay $1 million for a lobbyist to go woo some senators. If you go look and see who sits on these committees that appropriate funding, you tend to find out that those senators generally come from states like Florida, where these companies that make these rockets are located.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you what.
The next generation rocket, the thing that NASA is building next, as they've been ordered to by Congress, is called the SLS system. Okay. The SLS system is supposed to be this next generation rocket that will take us beyond Earth orbit, that could take us to Mars and all that. And it sounds great. You look at this thing on paper and you're like, this is an exciting thing. And then you look at it more closely and you realize what this is. Okay. It's called it's the exciting name. It stands for the Space Launcher System.
Okay.
Right?
Sure. Wait, what are you against space? Come on, man. It's just a space launcher.
I am. This is what it basically, the idea was, there are two ways to look at it. The charitable way is to say, hey, we have all this proven technology. We need to build on top of that. Right. The other way is to say it's the crony capitalism at work again, okay? The space launch system comprises of this is the technology involved there. It's got two solid rocket boosters like the shuttle had. Imagine that big, huge orange tank on top of the engines, the same engines you had in the shuttle.
I'm remembering this conversation now, and I'm getting mad just hearing it all over again.
Okay? This is what they said. This is what the SLS system is going to be, all right? Now, by the wording of the what Congress passed and the bill that was passed to fund this thing,
how recently did this come out?
What's that?
When did this funding happen?
I mean, it's been an ongoing, like, after one program where it's scrapped, you know, scraped, I think the recent funding, I got to look at, like, the recent approval was, like, 2010 or 2011. Okay? So, here's the thing, is the way this thing is worded is the only companies that can actually build this thing are the companies that were already building the space shuttle.
Ugh. Okay? All right.
So it's basically a no-bid contract. It's we're only going to let these companies do this. We're not going to let competition here. We're going to have such a narrow definition of what this is supposed to be that nobody else will be able to compete because, oh, you got to use these engines and they have a license. Oh, you got to use this booster because they have the license to it, okay? Now, theoretically, this is supposed to reduce the cost of getting into space.
Sure.
Hey!
You got rid of all that nasty competition.
Okay, and... You know, and actually, I think the booster rockets may not be the same as the shuttle. It may actually be the NK-33s, the Russian designs. So
it's a good rocket. It's a great rocket.
we're taking a system that we decided was not an efficient way to get $30,000 a pound to get into orbit. And we're getting rid of that reusable part.
Okay. All right. Now, but here's the thing. I mean, first of all, it actually makes sense. If what made it more expensive to begin with was the reusable part, then yeah, go ahead and get rid of it. So at least that's
that wasn't the part that made it more expensive. It was the tanks and everything else that you threw away after every launch.
All right. Well, that's a good point. Well, but regardless, there's safety concerns with the shuttle. Hopefully this will be safer. Let's just say, for sake of discussion, this is a step in the right direction.
$18 billion through 2017, over $3 billion a year worth of funding to go into this program with an indeterminate timeline of when this thing will really actually likely launch.
It won't.
It's lots of rockets. Me and Olaf go buy a big boar's meal. We eat it up.
There's no way this can... Okay, assuming SpaceX holds anywhere near to their plans... 3 years from now, this is going to be the bridge to nowhere. This is going to be the witch hunt to see who voted for this thing when all of a sudden, you know, you want to choose 1,000 times more expensive way to get something into space than what you could do through the private enterprise. I mean,
this has been the lobby. And, you know, I'll tell you what, maybe we should, what's it called, one of these days get my buddy Dave Leventhal from Politico.com, who runs the fantastic Politico Influence blog, where they track lobbyist money for all sorts of things, to maybe do like a space lobbyist kind of report.
Yeah.
And have money to talk about stuff like
space.
This. What's the nickname for this particular project?
Well, it's officially called the SLS. The nickname is the Senate Launch System because the amount of pork that went into this thing to get it passed is just incredible and unprecedented. And this is what NASA has to deal with. NASA's like, we want a rocket. And the senator's like, well, why don't you use these boosters? And remember why the space shuttle blew up the first time.
Yeah, pork kills astronauts.
Because a design flaw... That was only a flaw because of the way it had to be built and where it had to be built.
Because
go on.
Because certain senators had to promise work that came to their states so they could say that, you know, I brought X amount of space money to Alabama, Georgia, Florida.
The solid rocket booster, instead of making one long cylinder, it was divided into segments so it could be shipped across state lines and then reassembled.
Wow.
It was a structural problem. They're like, and be like, yeah, well, we can. It's a solvable thing. So, that's the state of what's happened before.
Wow.
Yeah.
The person that made that decision did not get fired. Nobody knows the name of the person that did that. You know, when a private company, if they have a mistake or they screw up, they go out of business.
Right. Right. No, the imprudent fail so that the prudent can scoop in and take advantage of the advancements.
Yeah, and there's always going to be it's space, and there's going to be complications. There's going to be problems. No technology is going to be perfect. But when you look at burdens that are imposed because of the politics of it, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
So NASA, NASA.
But I guess here's my point is. Let's say that SpaceX continues to rock the way it is, and let's say this thing continues to lumber forward to where it is. I mean, every year it's going to be more and more idiotic as you watch the two side by side. To where at some point, I'm going to say 5 years, this thing's gone.
Here's what happened. Okay, so NASA commissioned a study. NASA went to SpaceX, says, "Hey, if we wanted to have an equivalent rocket or bigger to take, you know, to be able to take one, an entire mission to Mars, what would that cost if we were to ask you guys to build it? And so they got, you know, had a couple $100,000 grant to SpaceX to try to figure out what it would cost to do this, doing what they understand about it. And SpaceX has been pretty spot on so far. SpaceX said, you know, it'd be one of a kind kind of thing, but $2.5 billion
is what is. Jesus. Wait, to go to Mars?
$2 would be the total cost that SpaceX says that they could build the same thing, which would actually be like for this program, which would be funded for development for the next 5 years or so. This would be about 10 months of funding for this program.
Oh my gosh. Dude, I hope that SpaceX continues to do well and have success, because we've been pretty big cheerleaders for them. And I'd hate to have massive
to really just
disaster.
Eat it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, but here's what's amazing. Here is why we live in a Jules Verne fantasy land, amazing, brilliant, gilded time. And we should all look at ourselves in the mirror and then look at each other and say, we are lucky, lucky to be alive, because what we're talking about right now, and you saying with certainty that, you know, like every year, and you're absolutely right, the further we get into this, the more this is going to seem like a ridiculous pork barrel, bridge to nowhere, boondoggle, nonsense pinata, and SpaceX is going to actually be bringing the future to us by making our path to space a regular occurrence. That we could not say that a week ago before SpaceX launched. We couldn't say it, you know, before Friday when they docked. We couldn't say it, you know, before they ran through all these kind of things. This is all what's happened over the last week is now we can conceptualize it. Now it's not just we have faith in these people. We think these people can do it. Now we've started to see huge milestones be absolutely ticked off that list. And that's amazing. It is, you know, that now we can say, look, SpaceX is that company, and hopefully
this week,
follow.
Astronauts on board the International Space Station for the first time stepped aboard a private spacecraft.
It's awesome, man. The Millennium Falcon just came in just to hang out for a bit, and then it's heading out of town.
Each of the stages that they needed to accomplish, they've already orbited a craft and got it back to Earth. Now they've put a craft into orbit. They've docked to the space station. They've done those things together. Will this mission do all of those? We don't know. But they've been proven they can do each single one of those things that 5 years ago, 4 years ago, even 3 years ago, people said they're not going to be able to do it. It's too hard. It's too difficult.
Right.
And there are more challenges to await. Reasonable is crazy.
I look forward to 20 years from now reading Atlas Shrugged 2032, the story of Elon Musk.
You know, there's a... And I tried to think of an analogy to this and what it could be like. And the closest I could think about was you get these incremental developments. You get a thing like the internet, which, you know, started off at I think it was CBN was one of the companies that worked on that. Then the government picked it up and it became the ARPANET and DARPANET and then internet. And it was this neat thing. If you were a big university or you were a government agency or a corporation, it meant nothing to you or me unless, you know, we paid access to, you know, somebody to give us a T1 or connection to that. Then a guy named Tim Berners-Lee says, hey, let me make this very easy graphic visual way to look at it, to understand the data there. And then some people create a thing called Mosaic. And then we get a thing called Netscape. And then we have a different way to look at online. And then we get $1 trillion added to our economy. And we realize this internet's a real thing.
Yeah.
And
well, and think about that. Like, maybe that's the best concrete example is if you're over the age of 30, you've already experienced one massive revolution in the economy and massive revolution of what's possible. Your world became much, much bigger in the 90s. From 1990 to 2000, your world doubled in size. That will happen again over the next 10 years. We're seeing the beginning of
Throw your hat over the wall. Seriously. I don't know where there's a wall, Brian, but you're wearing a hat. I want you to throw it.
I'm going to space in 15 years. There it is. I've said it.
Dropping bombs.
Why not, man? 15 years? Think about what could be different.
It's the exciting thing that I try to get at in my article is
you know, it, there's no certainty here at all, but it's not a matter of somebody says on paper, I have a plan. There is a rocket sitting on a pad in McGregor, Texas, that is to test this.
Yeah.
There are guys right now who have a calendar, who have a schedule, who have a spreadsheet in front of them of objectives they need to do. Tomorrow, Tuesday, back to work after Memorial Day, they're going to go out to this launch pad. They're going to tweak their wrenches. They're going to look at their laptops. They're going to do this thing. They're going to report in. And they have a time. They have a point at which they're going to try to test this. And then there's another thing. It's not a thing that could happen, that someday people are making this happen right now.
It's amazing.
And they want the test to read. And then mention more. The test to try to test the reusability thing of this will happen before we get to the finish of Game of Thrones on HBO.
That's amazing. Come on, man.
Just that simple.
Of course, there are other people that say that it's just as likely as us seeing the finish of Game of Thrones on HBO.
There is that.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what. You know, before we see.
Are you trying not to? You're trying not to make a spoiler.
Before we see the Dink ride a pig on television.
That's
we will have a massive revolution in space flight. So I'll tell you what, it's amazing. And I know that, listen, there's certainly, we've gotten a reputation, and now according to Google, I think we saw a big spike in traffic on the website, I think largely because we've talked so much about SpaceX and we've been such cheerleaders for SpaceX that, as it was a little bit of a news story this week, our page rank sort of, you know, really rocketed up, no pun intended. You know, I think it's yeah. I mean, I know. I think I speak for Andrew and Brian that we are absolute cheerleaders on this. But
by the way, is now as good a time as any for us to announce that Weird Things is now a wholly owned subsidiary of SpaceX.com? We can go ahead and tip that right now.
Did you see Elon Musk explain? They're asking, like, when they were trying to do their launch the Dragon or the ISS, they use a thing called LIDAR, somebody said what went wrong. He said, "Well, let me explain it to you. The Dragon uses a thing called lasers." And he did the Dr. Evil.
That's awesome. He's got a sense of humor to boot.
Do you know why the Falcon's called the Falcon?
Well, because it's a bird of prey that eats fish.
Brian, it's big and it's white. Why is it called the Falcon?
Because Pelican would be a dumb name.
False.
Why?
Millennium Falcon.
Oh, brain explosion. Are you serious?
Deadly.
The freaking Falcon landed on the space station. Oh, man. Well,
the Falcon did. The Dragon did, but the Falcon got it there.
Yeah. Whatever. It's awesome. Yeah,
same thing. Falcon was named after the Millennium Falcon.
That's awesome.
Well, there we go.
That's the guy grew up watching Star Wars. He's now making it happen.
Well, I'll tell you, you know what? I think
That was a layup. That was a layup just then, Justin.
I didn't have it queued up.
The two of us just, like, we were passing the ball back and forth. We both made significant glances to you.
Just to sum things up for everybody, this is Cisco saying we've made a better router. This is somebody saying, hey, we've got this really cool piece of technology. All the things that become possible now, okay? Space isn't just going to be SpaceX launching rockets. It's going to be planetary resources and these other companies maybe too. You know, it's going to be, Brian, how would you like to, do you like Maker, do you like to build things, do you like those, you know, 3D modeling machines?
Yeah, I guess it's all right. It's only you know, an opportunity to turn all of industrial distribution up on its head.
How would you like to work in a 3D manufacturing facility to make spare tools up in space?
I guess it'd be all right. Are you kidding me?
How cool would that be to be a maker in space?
I mean, I'll tell you what. Every so often, the singularity doesn't sound like a nutty idea. All of a sudden, I think that maybe I'll live to see full on the equipment. Because think of it: you get a maker bot up in the space station, you essentially have an Enterprise and a replicator. Like, those are real things. That's amazing.
Yeah, and that's you know, and then you're going to get crazy money spent. Larry Ellison and Paul Allen are going to have a contest with their wangs, but they're going to be like space yachts.
Yes. Spangs.
You know, space yachts. When you get to when you get to $1,000 a pound, that becomes a possibility. When you get to $10 per pound, okay, when you take your car in your driveway and you realize, man, I could put that in space
for the price I paid for it.
It's awesome.
Awesome. It's just that simple, folks.
Do we want to do picks?
Yeah.
We have one more reminder.
I said, do we want to do another commercial?
Remember, folks, that Destination Jim makes funny videos. You can go to youtube.com/DestinationJim. He can also be followed on the Twitter, Destination_Jim. Also,
wait, how do you spell Jim? Is that G-Y-M or J-I-M?
Destination_Jim. He also wanted to make sure that I wore a shoe on my head.
He's got his shoe on his
head. That's what $30 will get you.
Let it never be said that Justin Robert Young is not the Ron Popeil of weird podcasts.
Or the pancake rabbit.
Absolutely. So check it out. Destination Jim on YouTube. YouTube.com/DestinationJim. Pick time.
I actually got something I'm listening to right now, and I'm undecided about it. I don't usually just buy things more than a book at a time on Audible, but I figured diving in for a penny, in for a pound. And I am listening to the George R.R. Oh, my God. By the way, let me just put this plug in right now because you're going to hear it a lot over the next 3 weeks. Do you realize that the Scam School book hit number 3 in the United States and we lost to 50 Shades of Grey because we came out the same week as that unstoppable trilogy? We were able to defeat the third of them, but not the other two. And so, like, freaking this go round, total war, bitches. I mean, it's like, it's Scam School Book 2 coming out June 19th. But
Ryan, I'm such a pal, I'll even send out a tweet for that.
What? Well, thank you very much.
So that's what friends do. They tweet each other's books.
Have I not tweeted your book?
Oh, I didn't say anything about me.
I could have sworn that I did. Oh my gosh! I'm sorry. I gotta. You know what? I don't think I've started reading Hollywood Pharaohs. I need to start doing that right away.
What? Yeah, a good time to tweet is actually around 11 a.m. on a Tuesday morning.
Okay, that's good. I will do that tomorrow morning then.
What's the George R. R. Martin?
Back in the 80s, he edited a series of short stories called Wild Cards, and It's vaguely reminiscent. If you like The Watchmen, I guess would be the early parts of it. But basically, there's a space alien shows up, and he's got a conundrum, which is he's a space alien that has the same biology as humans. And in fact, it's rumored that maybe humans, you know, were a colony of these guys. But they got this virus, and there's two warring factions, right? And so they're like, well, do we want to try the virus on our enemies? Because maybe that would decimate our enemies. They're like, well, problem is, virus, maybe it decimates them. Also, maybe it gives them superpowers. Wait, superpowers? Those are rad. Why don't we test it on ourselves? Well, did you miss the part about maybe decimates them? See, we don't really know half the people. Everyone's different. That's where the wild cards come from. And they're like, got it. Let's go down and just drop it on humanity. See what happens, bro. And so somebody's given the job to do it, and reluctantly he doesn't want to do it, but somebody disperses this biological weapon. Everyone gets the disease, and it affects everybody differently. A lot of people go about their normal lives. A lot of people draw what they call jokers, where it's all of a sudden they have scales and feathers and arms, you know, falling off. And other people draw aces. You know, you got dudes who glow golden and can lift cars and stuff. And it goes, I haven't read the rest of it, but it was from the 1980s. And right now it starts like during World War II. And I'm up to around the mid 1950s when a few of the aces, the four aces, they've kind of formed a super team, get called up in the House Committee on American Affairs. What's that one? Un-American Activities.
Right.
The HUAC or whatever. It's I'm really enjoying it so far, but,
cool.
So I'll tell you, I'll give you a full report when I finish it.
Yeah, you know, remember the there was like the Marvel Comics thing, like Strike Force Moratori?
Oh, no, I never saw that.
So let me I think I got the name right. And that was kind of a cool Strike Force Moratori, and it came out in 1986, and the premise was, like, aliens invade Earth, and they're almost conquered us, and a scientist develops a way to give us superhuman powers, but it, like, gives you, like, you die within a year of getting your powers.
Oh, that's rough.
That's... So it was basically you're going to have these characters that you'd like, and then you'd watch them go try to defend. You know, it's we who are about to die. Strike Force Moratori.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, kind of a. I guess it was kind of an '80s thing. Like, yeah, aliens, powers, you're gonna die.
Yeah,
I have a pick.
Go.
It's right behind me.
What?
Hold on.
That looks like a lightsaber. Is that a lightsaber?
Ryan, I'm holding in my hands.
What? Those
on
look
my
like
left hand. I'm holding a classic lightsaber.
Is that like a Force FX one? What is that?
This is the like the beginner Hasbro model.
It's not bad.
Sure. Nice lightsaber, right?
Yeah.
Okay, pretty cool. Okay. Audience there, it's kind of a nice color. But let's say I'm going to, like, I don't know, Dragon Con.
Yeah. So you
let's say I'm going to Dragon Con, and maybe, I don't know, maybe somebody out there, maybe a Amtrekker or one of the many other people that I've got a gripe with. Okay.
One of the many people I want to kill.
Okay. Maybe Dan Dirks and his trash talking. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Maybe it's going to come to blows. Okay. And maybe I'm going to be in my, maybe I'm a Sith, maybe I'm not, kind of get up.
Sure.
Okay. With my Jedi robes and my black eye makeup.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe there's going to be a fight and I'm going to have my lightsaber. Now, do I want to use my nice little.
No, man.
Okay, you know, my based Hasbro? On the Graflex design,
no
or
way.
I want to use something a little more powerful because when I get into a fight,
God,
what
I
is that?
Pump that lightsaber.
That looks amazing.
All right, this baby, solid.
What is going on?
This is a combat lightsaber. There are two companies that I know of that make them. One is called Park Sabers. This one's from Ultra Sabers. Okay. And
so these are designed to take abuse.
You can see the different line. This is like one of the more basic models. And I'm going to show to, you know, people watching, this is an all aluminum.
Yeah, no, it's spun grip. Like they clearly had it like on a lathe where they cut it all down.
This has got this, this plastic, the blade part of it, which if we're in the Star Wars universe, I just burned off my fingers, but right. I used a force technique.
You know, force stopping thing.
Yeah, hey, actually, this is a robotic hand, so I can touch it.
I guess.
Anyhow, the ultimate sabers, this saber is like, this thing is strong. You can whack it into stuff. I almost hit my iPad with it.
So, wait, okay. it's designed to, unlike the Hasbro one, where it's like, they say, don't hit anything with it, but meanwhile, it clearly makes an awesome sound effect when you hit it. So, but it breaks it, right? Whereas this guy, this guy's designed for abuse.
And the way it works is there are other lightsabers there that have LED lights that go all the way up the shaft, lights all the way up the shaft, okay?
Yeah.
But if you get into a fight and you start banging it around, okay?
They go out.
The problem is the LEDs can snap and they can break off and you can bruise your shaft, okay?
Sure.
Damage it. Yeah. Now, the way this shaft works, I want you to look closely, is...
Look at your shaft.
I can use two little screws that undo it, and I can pull my shaft free... And it's just one super bright LED light inside of there that illuminates the shaft.
So two screws and your light and your shaft just goes blah.
Bright red. Bright red.
Jesus.
That's amazing.
Your children.
What about you, Justin? What do you got going on?
I don't know what's up with Justin. So this is my it was like $60 or $70. Okay. So I'm all set. All right.
Yeah.
Hear that Amtrak?
Now, you have modules you can get for this, by the way. They have sound modules. They have this. They have different designs. The traditional lightsaber, okay, that we're used to from Star Wars was based, remember, on like a light gun, okay? That was what it came from. It was called a Graflex light gun that was used for like a flash. They found like large quantities of these, and they will actually take those and make you lightsabers based upon that. So you can have a lightsaber that looks like a classic Star Wars one. But it's not violating the copyright because they use the same thing it was made from, and those are called Graflex. And so they make those even brighter than this bad boy.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's a good looking piece. His shaft, I'll tell you, I've seen it. He's pulled it out for me when I visited his apartment, and I gotta say, impressive.
Very, never let him touch
most
it.
Most impressive.
Never let him touch it.
Most impressive. All right,
I got a hat trick of picks real quick. Number one, first and foremost, of course, released this week. Number four. On the Amazon best reviewed list is the brand new tome from Andrew Main, Hollywood Pharaohs, which I read a while ago, and I read the first two chapters of on the new Andrew Main Stories podcast. So if you want just a free taste of it, you can go ahead, head over there. But I absolutely love it. It's been called the Big Lebowski meets Indiana Jones, and it really lives up to that. It's you know, if you dig, I mean, I kind of described it as, you know, two elements that Andrew's kind of fused together. The action, the super high intensity action pacing of Public Enemy Zero, if you like that, and just the big imagination, the blue sky, you know, super fun, exhilarating creativity of A Chronological Man. But this time it's placed into contemporary Los Angeles. So you kind of get your commentary on, you know, a very the healthy end of our pop culture and our obsession with movies and loving big fantasies and what that creates, and also the darker side and sort of, you know, the hangers on and the criminality element of it. And it's all spun together in this, you know, this big, awesome, pulpy adventure with a very likable main character and an awesome heroine. So I think everybody should go pick it up again, like most Andrew Main books. This is 99 cents for now. It will not be like that forever, but go ahead and check it out. Or again, if you're like, I don't know, bro, I'm kind of interested, but I want to keep my fingers on my digital dollar, go ahead and listen to the first two chapters on the Andrew Main Stories podcast and just
tell
see
you what,
you
Justin,
think.
Why don't we put those chapters at the end of this podcast?
Oh, gosh darn it. You want to know what? That's fine. Just, you don't even have to go to the Andrew Main Stories podcast. You can just stay listening and you'll hear it right at the end of this, and it'll be all right, folks. So check that out. Secondarily, friend of this podcast, friend of me, Brian and Andrew, Ryan Connolly did a short story called, a short film rather, called Tell, which you can go on and search on the Film Riot. Of course, he does Film Riot. You can go search on that, that YouTube, and you'll find a link to it. I think it's at the Triune Films YouTube. Fantastic. He's an absolute talent, and you should really go watch it. And then the last one, I wanted to point it out. This book I picked up at like a comic book sale a while ago, and I just got around to reading it because I'm moving everything out of my room as I move. But it's called The Skrull Kill Crew. It's written by Grant Morrison and Mark Millar. Mark Millar, of course, Superman, Red Son.
Can I just say, he had to describe this to me twice.
Yes.
And it was I understood everything he said the first time. I just couldn't believe that's exactly what he was saying. I'm like, wait, no, describe this to me again. I'm like, nope, that's exactly what I thought you meant.
Like, those are not even words. Stop.
Okay, so basically it's a story of two guys who you find out why they are A, able to identify them, and B, have a vendetta against them, but they're just going around killing Skrulls. If you're unfamiliar with the Marvel Universe, Skrulls
are bad people. Bad dudes.
Yeah, they're a race of aliens that can change their shape and are dead set on infiltrating humanity and bringing us to an untimely end. So the first, you know, the first scenes you see of this comic book are two absolute thuggish looking dudes busting into a school, shooting the school teacher, and then shooting an 8-year-old who are Skrulls. They can
wow.
see them as Skrulls. It's, if you like They Live, it's very They Live inspired. It's, if you like Mark Millar, Grant Morrison is a very weird writer. He's a very good writer, very talented writer. But let's just say that part of the reason why they can identify these Skrulls is sexually transmitted. And that's all I'll leave you to right there. So check it out. Skrull Kill Crew. I have no idea if you can buy it. I found it at a comic book store, but I'm sure you can look it up somewhere.
Wow. You look like you have something you want to share, Andrew.
No, I'm just, I just, it was one of those things, like, and kind of like, what do you say? And I'm like, oh, Grant Morrison. Got it.
Yeah.
Everything Grant else Morrison, writes itself.
I have a weird take. I mean, Grant Morrison, I love his stuff, but it's always one of those things where it's like, oh, man, this is really well written. But also, did the hero need to be a cross-dressing LSD addict who had to blow the cockroach alien to save the world so it didn't turn itself inside out? Like, it's just, it's like, sometimes it's a little weird for the sake of being weird.
Well, that just belongs as a pick on weird things.
There we go.
Well, boys and girls, this has been a delightfully long episode of Weird Things, but we just obviously we were just bursting with excitement to talk again about SpaceX, but we waited till the end to do that. We know a lot of you are excited about it, and some people are skeptical, and you know, skepticism is fine. Cynicism is something else, but man, what an awesome week. What a horrifying week if you're into zombies. What an awesome week if you're into space.
What a weird week.
Yeah. It's a good way to put it, Brian. It's been weird.
Boom!
It's been weird.
Yeah!
Yeah!
I'd like to say it's been weird.
What?
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.
Chapter 1. A Long Time Ago. The leader of the Royal Guard slammed the butt of his spear into the old farmer's jaw and sent him to the ground. The other people in the mob shook angry fists, but kept their distance when the phalanx of guards pointed the tips of their spears at them, threatening that the next blow would be fatal. Frustrated, the leader of the guards turned to the man on his left.
"Tell the priest to hurry."
The younger man, Nefem, nodded his head and sprinted for the temple. He ran past the row of gods looking down from the gallery on either side of the plaza and took the dirt path that led to the top of the temple. Already half buried, the entire complex was being sealed away forever. He reached the skylight above the main chamber and shouted down to the priests,
"Seal it now or be sealed inside with her!"
An old priest looked up at him.
"The rites must be done."
"I don't think the mob cares much for the rites," replied Nefem.
The priest shook his head.
"They must understand."
"They're hungry, and their fields are bare,"
he pointed to the sarcophagus below.
"They blame her."
"You took an oath to protect,"
replied the priest as he pushed two servants to affix a seal.
"And I did."
He paused and added,
"as well as to her family. And now they're all gone. We have to see that she's left unmolested, then move on."
The old priest climbed the ladder with the help of the servant on the last rungs. He turned and watched the other priests leave the chamber, then motioned for the workers to move the massive stone blocks into place, sealing it forever. Satisfied that the temple would at least withstand the mob for a night, he turned to Nefem.
"It's a shame to rush such things."
"It's a shame to desecrate the names of the innocent."
The priest gave him a long look.
"We were all innocent once."
"Even her?"
The priest nodded his head and walked toward the path that led down from the mound.
"Yes, even her. Poison gets us all in the end. Sometimes it's in the potion, other times it's in our hearts. Hers was the acid of vanity, the long, slow death that tears you apart from the inside until you're nothing more than a shell."
Nefem cast a glance back at the workers, covering the tomb with earth, and shook his head. The sooner it was buried and forgotten, the better. Greek by ancestry, he lived in Egypt all his life, but thought of it as a dead place, where even the ghosts had long vanished, replaced by foreigners like himself, play-acting a history buried thousands of years before. Chapter 2. L.A. Goddess. 100 million per breast, or at least that's what one of the snarky Hollywood bloggers said about her asking price. When she breaks the surface of the water, I get a free glimpse. The sun is low in the sky, completing the effect of the golden hour, that perfect time for shooting perfume ads and romantic scenes on the beach. Only I can't focus on her. As soon as she emerges, I notice something beyond her flawless breasts and the marble colonnades that line the pool. I stand up and try to get a look over the hedge in the back of the estate. Is that Harold Lloyd's old place? Her assistant, a Mediterranean-looking young man in a suit that costs more than my car, drops the edge of her bathrobe in the pool as he hands it to her. I think he's upset the Teresa effect wasn't working on me. All the big stars have their way of impressing you with their celebrity. Might be a portrait and their likeness by a famous painter standing in the entrance, although that's kind of hack now. Or they'll use a handful of assistants hovering around them to show you how goddamn busy and important they are. Older stars have all the awards for you to see and giant posters of the movies they appeared in, at least the good ones. They also insist that they're always working on some big projects. The more times they stress that, the less likely they are. For Teresa White, the show is herself. Her mansion is filled with a collection of paintings and sculptures, a nice mixture of traditional pieces and recent works that reflect her art school background. Everything screams that she has taste and that she's classy with a capital C. I walk around the marble tiles surrounding the pool to step onto the grass by the tall hedge. Through a small gap, I spot the tall trees and columns that caught my eye. Teresa steps out of the pool and crosses the grass behind me to see what I'm staring at. See something interesting? Her voice is confident. There's a hint of sarcasm. Yeah, sorry, Roman world. I step back and let her have a look. She pushes the leafy hedge aside. The robe is clinging to her wet skin. You can see the outline of her designer swim briefs. I think that they're the same one she's wearing in the billboard over Melrose Avenue. Interesting. Her voice trails off. I explain what I saw. That's where the robots went berserk and killed all the theme park guests. Kind of a slave revolt. I'm not sure if he meant to be ironic or not. Westworld, replies Teresa. Yeah, they used one of those Lloyd gardens to shoot some of the Rome scenes. I didn't realize your place was this close. Teresa steps back down from the embankment and turns toward me. 1973, directed by Michael Crichton. I think it grossed $4 million. Is that one of your favorite films? The question is like an adult asking a child if the Spider-Man action figures are his favorite toys. Not really. Just a bit of a hobby. Kind of distracting. I follow her back to the couches in the open living room. In this town, I imagine so. She gives me a long glance before sitting down in the white leather couch across from me. A table covered with books of Egyptian hieroglyphics lay between us. I thought you were him when I first saw you. The likeness is incredible. She's talking about Alex Race, the movie actor with my face. Well, technically his face, since he's 3 years older than me, but I still think of it as mine. I can feel her eyes scrutinizing me, trying to spot the difference. Sitting still, it's kind of hard. We move differently and have very different expressions. A small smile forms in the corner of her mouth. I see the difference. So do I. I'm sure. She points her long tan arm at the mirror behind her. You haven't looked at yourself once. I'm sure Alex wouldn't be able to control himself. I'm sure a few of us, we're like vampires. We crave our own reflection. My gaze flickers to the pool and the entrance she just tried to make until I was distracted by the movie location. Teresa raises her eyebrow and flashes her perfect small teeth. I know. I'm no different. I doubt many of them are as self-aware as you are. I try to compliment her for at least being self-aware. What's it like having the face of one of the most famous men in the world? She scoots to the edge of the couch and leans her chin on a fist attentively. It's her eyes. Forget the flash of cleavage or the wet clinging robe. Her eyes are fierce, intelligent, off-balancing. There was nothing condescending in her tone, but her eyes tell another story. It's a pain in the ass. I didn't mean to give her my honest answer. It's her damn eyes. It must have its advantages. The eyes flash at the suggestion. You mean, do I ever try to get laid because of it? I'm not that kind of guy. A girl has to be in for the sad reality and not the fantasy. Besides, when someone finds out that I'm not him, no matter how much I've insisted, it's like the scene in The Crying Game where Stephen Ray finds out that he just slept with a dude from Stargate. I doubt that, Michael. She uses my first name informally. I can understand her charm. Attractive. Smart. It's easy to see how she can talk her way around a bunch of middle-aged producers. She's flirty without being desperate. The topless show is just her way of saying that she's a sexual being. But the art says she has culture. I don't doubt this. I get the feeling that a lot of her taste might come from her immaculately dressed assistant watching me from the corner. But at least she has the sense to hire someone like him. I bet anything he's from an Ivy League school and never thought about working in the film industry until he met her. She waves her assistant over to us. He picks up an iPad off the table and sits down on the couch next to me. I can smell his cologne. It's the male counterpart of her designer fragrance. Show him the necklace, Jacob. He taps open a photo album to a photograph of a necklace with a long gold rectangle spaces in between the teardrop gems. The gold resembles rays of the sun, while the blue suggests the sky. I've been told repeatedly that my taste in jewelry is on par with the people who make Cracker Jack prizes. But this thing is stunning. It's the kind of art that a snob and a cretin can appreciate. The symbolism's obvious. Amidst all the glittering gold and blue gems, the wearer of the necklace would be the center of the universe. The image of the necklace on the screen is faded. The edges have creases. It's a scan of a very old photograph. I want that necklace, says Teresa. It was a gift from a Macedonian general to an Egyptian princess. At least, it was in the film. I don't recognize the necklace or the reference. Sands of the Nile, 1954. It was Amanda Gray's last starring role. Hugo Harrison's last production before he got out of the film business entirely and focused on taking over Las Vegas and telecommunications. The film sat on a shelf for 2 years. It was one of the most expensive productions ever. Only Harrison didn't want anyone to know this. And you want the necklace? Teresa nods. Jacob thinks it's one of the most authentic pieces to have ever appeared in a film, and may be a genuine necklace that Harrison bought as a gift for Amanda Gray. I'm considering a role in a film about the first Macedonian princess in Egypt. I'd like to have this necklace for the Academy Awards next week, where I'll be presenting. Her hand touches the place between her breasts where the necklace would lay. I shake my head. I'm not sure I understand. Alex says you used to be a cop. He insists that you're quite resourceful. I want you to find the necklace for me. Whoa, I'm not a gopher. I think you have the wrong guy. Try a private detective. The words are a reaction and not well thought out. I wanted to ask you first. Time is very important. I've been dying to get out from underneath Alex's thumb. Going to work for another crazy celebrity isn't exactly my escape plan. Not that I have an escape plan. Do you like living in a guest house? The words cut like a knife. I've been staying the past few months in a small house in the back of an estate that one of Alex's producer's pals has. She holds up her hands apologetically. I don't mean to offend you. Believe me, I spent more time sleeping on friends' couches and in my car than I wanted. Pretty girls like her don't have to do that in this town. Not if they're willing to put up with a rich older boyfriend that's a bit of a bore. I can tell she's different. Teresa isn't the type to suffer fools. despite her exhibitionist streak. I think the rumors about her conservative mores are probably true. No offense taken. It's not all bad. Rent's cheap. This is a job where you'd be doing what you were meant to do, not parading around to fool a paparazzi. I'll pay you $10,000 up front and another $25,000 if you can find the necklace. That's a lot of cash. Not exactly fuck you money, but enough for me to tell Alex no for a few months if he asked me to do something harebrained like stand in for him in a Japanese beer commercial while he gets laid in some Tokyo penthouse. Teresa can tell I'm thinking it over. Michael, it would mean a lot to me. There's something sincere in her voice. She's making a request, not ordering around a lesser. Why so much? I'm sure there's 100 private dicks in this town that would love to do it for a fraction. I'm sure there are. But we don't have much time, and I don't need them stirring things up. I need this handled quickly and discreetly. Alex says you're the man. I don't have a choice. I'll take a look. Her lips part and reveal her smile. Great. Can Jacob write you a check, or would you like cash? Now, I'm broke. I've got $600 shoved under my mattress at home and about $30 in my pocket. And I'll end up using that to put half a tank of gas in my beat-up Toyota. I can't tell you how hard it is for me to say what I tell her, but I got pride. Just let me look into it for a day or so, and then I'll take your money. That's a kindness, Michael. Alex spoke well of your character. Alex? I'm surprised to hear he'd say anything positive to a woman like Teresa about me, unless it's some angle for him to get laid. Teresa bids me goodbye to take a phone call. Jacob follows me out to the car. He tries hard not to notice the dirty windows and banged-up side door. Probably gave him a heart attack at the thought of anyone seeing the car parked on the driveway. Can I... He pauses for a moment, trying not to look at the car. Can we give you some kind of fee for expenses? It's his way of giving me a discreet chance to say yes to the money away from Teresa. I shake my head. I'm not a parasite. I wouldn't have let you in the door if I thought you were. I appreciate it. I'll let you guys know in a day or so if I get a good lead. He watches with a pained expression as I type his number on my ancient phone. I've had it for years, back before Alex ruined my life. Jacob steps closer to me. She understands the value of money, so I don't think she was trying to throw it in your face. I'm sure.
I'm sure the rug I walked on when I stepped inside cost more.
Just be careful. His voice trails off. Careful? We're only dragging down a necklace. It's not like I'm going to go against the Russian mafia. Jacob gives me a faint smile. As it would turn out, the Russian mafia has nothing on the Estonians in ingenuity or the Nevada mob in persistence.